Maxwell Graduate School of Citizenship and Public Affairs at Syracuse University. Professor Odegaard.
In continuing our discussion of Congress and the legislative process, we have as our guest today one of the most distinguished authorities on this problem in the country, Professor Stephen K. Bailey, who, as you know, is Dean of the Maxwell School of Citizenship and Public Affairs at Syracuse University. Steve Bailey has had a long and varied career, not as long as someone else I could name, but nevertheless more impressive. Steve was a Rhodes Scholar at Oxford University. He took his PhD at Harvard, and he has taught in a number of places, including Wesleyan University, as a visiting professor at Oxford, at Harvard, and for a while was director of the graduate program at Princeton University, before going to Syracuse as dean of the Maxwell School. He's been in the public service in a number of capacities, the Board of Economic Warfare, 1942, as an administrative assistant to Senator William Benton, as a member of the Connecticut Commission on State Government, and not least, by any means, mayor of Middletown, Connecticut. So that Steve has seen government not only from the point of view of the expert or the legislator, but also from the point of view of the elected executive. Some years ago, Professor Bailey published a book, one of many that he has published, called Congress Makes a Law. I commend it to you because, in my judgment, it still remains the best single volume on the total legislative process. I mean, not just the formal proceedings in Congress, but the kind of thing that goes on around the fringes and the edges of a legislative assembly when it is engaged in the business of coming to some kind of agreement on an important matter of public policy. Steve, it's wonderful to have you here this morning to carry on our conversation about Congress.
Thank you, Peter, very much.
I hope that you don't get caught in a snowstorm on your way back to Syracuse.
It's almost inevitable.
Steve, let me ask you a question to begin with, a question that has been asked me many times, and that is whether or not Congress, as at present organized, is adequate or competent to do what it was originally established to do. And as you know, the familiar high school description of our government, that's like Gaul, it's divided into three parts, and the president carries out the laws, the Supreme Court interprets the laws, but Congress makes the laws. Now, how competent is Congress to do this?
Peter, I don't know of any more important question than the one you've led off with, largely because Congress, I think, is on the defensive. Lots of people are asking questions about whether, in the kind of world we live in, there is a function for a body of deliberators. As you know far better than I, around the world in the last few years, as new governments have come up in Africa and Asia, one of the first things that disappears is not the Constitution, but the legislature.
Yeah.
And they try it for a while and it doesn't work, and then a general takes over, or a president, or a politician with, I think what it's called in the trade, charisma, the capacity to lead people as a kind of savior. What is it about the 20th century that makes the life of Congress so difficult? I'd like just to throw out two or three items. One is, it seems to me, the 20th century has been an age of crisis, and psychologically, people tend to look to an individual, a political leader, like the president in our society, as the protector, the savior. Congress is many people, it's many things, and it's very hard to keep it in focus. And with the crises of war, of depression, of a continued strain and frustration in our Cold War relationships around the world, people look increasingly to the solemn singularity of the presidency, saying, this is the fellow we've got to look to save us from all this. So in one sense, and just in terms of the front page, Congress gets overshadowed. Tied in with this, however, is the fact that Congress is called upon today to deal with a range of issues which are unbelievably complex in their nature. I have a little quotation I brought along from T. Swan Harding, who wrote a few years ago, "It is up to Congress as a whole to grasp and decide upon the justice of appropriations for such projects as the use of endocrines to increase egg production, the role of John's disease, coccidiosis, and worm parasites in cattle production, the production of riboflavin from milk byproducts, spot treatment with soil fumigants for the control of root knot nematode on melons, the use of mass releases of Macrocentis ancillivoris to control oriental fruit moth injury, and the conversion of lactose into methyl acrylate to be polymerized with butadiene for the production of synthetic rubber."
Well, now, Steve, look, this is a reductio ad absurdum, really, isn't it? It is not Congress's responsibility to pass upon any of those things. And isn't a great deal of the concern that has been expressed about Congress and about legislative assemblies around the world, which you quite rightly say have been in eclipse in recent years, isn't a great deal of this concern the result of a failure to understand just what a legislative or representative assembly can do? One of the things that it cannot do, obviously, and never was intended to do, was the kind of thing that T. Swan Harding indicated there.
Peter, the difficulty, you see, is that while I agree with your general proposition that Congress ought to deal with general considerations of relating, say, technology to the public interest, when it gets down to the details of legislating, the kinds of questions that are raised in, say, a subcommittee of the House Appropriations Committee about the activity of an agency actually gets into just exactly this kind of technology. Now, you may argue that it shouldn't, but the fact is that it does, and I would argue, I think, that in the area of, well, take an area like atomic energy, that it is very difficult to sort out where the lay mind is adequate in the Congress for dealing with things, and where technical knowledge is imperative if sound legislation is going to be passed. Now, I remember a conversation with Brian McMahon, the late senator from Connecticut, who, as you know, was
really father of the Atomic Energy Commission.
Yes. Exactly. McMahon once said to me, "I don't know how we in Congress are expected to legislate intelligently on the vastly complex matters of nuclear science, atomic energy, the whole question of the military uses, civilian uses in this field, particularly when you have secrecy in government, part of it necessary, I think actually a great deal of it unnecessary, part of it just a simple question of the volume of detail that must be somehow put together into policy shape." And if you ask a congressman like McMahon, or a senator like McMahon, to take on trust all of the technical details, then he can rightfully say, "Look, I am really your victim. I am building up a body of detail, of expertise here, on the basis of your say-so. Then you tell it to me, and I'm trying to make a general policy out of it, and then the rest of the congressmen look to me, the rest of Congress looks to me, with a kind of deference, because I'm the only fellow who spent enough time talking with you."
Steve, could I make two comments on that, on that illustration? The first comment I would make is that Senator McMahon and the committee that had that matter in charge at the time the Atomic Energy Act of 1946 was put through, were not asked at any time to make decisions upon whether or not you use this kind of a process or that kind of a process in the development of plutonium, let us say. They were asked to make very, very important decisions as to whether or not the whole development of atomic energy in the United States was to be under the control of the Army and the armed services, or whether it was to be under the control of a civilian agency. And they made this decision after long and careful deliberation, as you know, and after a great deal of pressure had been put upon them and upon the Congress in support of the so-called May Bill, which would have left this whole matter in the hands of the military. Now, this kind, I'm not saying that the decision of the Congress was right or wrong. I happen to believe it was right, because I believe this is a matter that should be under the control, under civilian control, and not under military control. The point I'm making is that the kind of decision they had to make was the kind of decision that only Congress can make, that only a body that is representative of the people, as to whether or not this shall be in the hands of a military command or a civilian body. This is one comment I'd make on this illustration.
Right.
The second comment I would make is that it is true that when you get into subcommittee hearings on particular pieces of legislation, and this is not only true of atomic energy, this is not only true of these complex problems involved in space and all the rest of it, but even in matters involving tax incidents and so on and so on, these are complex problems, and the average member of Congress is not terribly well informed. He doesn't have much expertise on these problems. On the other hand, my impression is, from sitting through a good many of these hearings, is that the people who have served for any length of time on these special committees are probably as well informed, Steve, as anybody in the United States, including many of the experts who testify before them. I think, for example, of old Carl Vinson on armed services. I think Clarence Cannon, who used to hold the hearings on the subcommittee on the Treasury and so on, Treasury agencies. It is not true that the average congressman's mind is a kind of a cave of the winds. It isn't. It may be a cave of the winds on many things, but in the course of years of indoctrination and training before in these special committees, these subcommittees particularly, he develops a kind of expertise that I think goes beyond the expertise of the specialist himself, simply because it is tempered by a broader conception of the total needs of the nation and the economy.
Peter, I think these are very valuable comments. I would only suggest that the expertise, as you point out, of some of the most distinguished members of Congress who've been there for many, many years, is a two-edged sword.
I agree.
The expertise is there, but oftentimes this is coupled with a reasonably narrow and parochial view of what the public interest is. Now, one can argue that this is the function of Congress, to represent a whole series of parochial views, that is, of limited views of geographical areas and small bundles of people around the country. But I think one of the continuing criticisms of Congress, one of the reasons why Congress is on the defensive, is because a good deal of expertise is in the hands of so-called old-timers, who have gotten there by seniority and whose adjustment to the world of the 20th century, to the world we now live in, is not always in gear with the needs of the country.
I agree. But could I add a footnote, Steve, to that? It is not only, we're not compelled, and Congress is not compelled, to rely upon the accumulated expertise that people like Carl Vinson and Clarence Cannon, people like this, develop. Because, fortunately in this country, I think fortunately, the American people have been terribly liberal with our Congress. It's probably the best staffed legislative body in the world.
No question.
And the legislative staff that is now provided, I think, for example, the one that I had most contact with the staff of the Joint Committee on Internal Revenue. Now, the staff of this committee,
Colin Stamm
and this group, will stand with any experts in the Treasury Department, in the Federal Reserve System, in Commerce, or anywhere else, in terms of their knowledge, their wisdom, and they serve Congress. They serve even the new congressmen on these special committees. Steve. So that all I'm saying is that I don't take quite as dim a view of the competence of Congress to deal even with these difficult problems as some people seem to take.
Well, all I was trying to do at the beginning, Peter, was to outline some of the reasons why Congress seems to be on the defensive.
Yes,
on some of these issues, and your corrective here is certainly part of the positive statement that I think has got to be made about the continuing values of Congress. Congress is an easy whipping boy. You know, every time something goes wrong, we can blame a congressman or a group of congressmen, and we stop to think about the positive values of this body far too infrequently. I'd like to suggest some, in my estimation, some of the continuing values of Congress. Why it is not an answer to our present problems simply to turn everything over to the presidency. Even though I think in some areas, increasingly, discretion has got to be given within congressional bounds.
I do too.
To the president on matters of tariff, on matters perhaps of public works and other things of this kind. But the fact is that the Congress has at least four or five functions that spell, in my estimation, the difference between a free society and a totalitarian society. And I would like to, if I can, just mention a few of these that seem to me so terribly important. One I think you've touched on already in your comments about Carl Vinson and others. Congress is a great refiner of legislative proposals. There was a naive view, you know, some time ago that what Congress really did for a living was to sit down and write bills out.
Yeah.
It doesn't do this. Bills are written, 95-98% of them, somewhere else. But they are put into the congressional hopper, and through the committee hearing process, through the long experience of some of our legislative statesmen, these bills are put under a series of microscopes, and a variety of points of view are brought to bear upon them. Lots of things are bargained out, but in the process there is what I would call a refining process, a taking of a rough thing and polishing the edges on it. So I think that increasingly Congress has a role to play as the refiner of legislative proposals, which oftentimes are put in with surely much thought, but without the full range of interests represented around the country.
I'm sure of that.
The second thing that I think that Congress does, and does supremely well, is to act as a launching pad for new ideas. Even though it doesn't write de novo, a good deal of legislation, congressmen travel, they are recipients of constituent mail. They're a place where new ideas can be pushed up into the air, and surely many of them shot down. But some of them survive, and I can think of things like the Monroney Resolution, which really came out of Mr. Monroney's concern with the whole problem of foreign aid, for example. I can think of activities a few months ago when Senator Humphrey came back from South America with proposals about the common market and how we might have a legislative, common market of the hemisphere. This wasn't President Kennedy's proposal at the time, but this is an idea that maybe should be built into the considerations of our relationships to the common market in Europe. Constantly, there are new ideas coming up, bubbling up, as a result of congressional interest and the concern that Congress has with the public interest. Third place, I think that Congress is a great homogenizer. I think you've used the word disciplinarian of group interests in our society. Sometimes we think of Congress, you know, as being a kind of neutral thing with lots of pressure groups coming down like wolves on the fold. And they're ready to be eaten, or in a kind of collusive way, they collaborate and
or that they push Congress around.
That's right. Well, congressmen have a lot more power than this in many cases. And I would think that this capacity to look at a variety of interest groups and the pressures that come up and test these pressures against a broader concern of what is in the public interest is one of the great functions of the United States Congress. And believe me, there are, as you well know, safeguards involved here in having group interests around competing with each other. I remember when I was working in the Senate on the staff of Senator Benton, we introduced a bill on the Hoover Commission recommendations. And the next day, a representative from one of the agricultural interest groups called me and he said, is your senator trying to torpedo us? Is he trying to destroy us? And I said, for goodness sake, no, why should he try to destroy you? And he said, well, have you looked at paragraph 3, subsection 6 of the agricultural section of the reorganization bill that your senator introduced? And I said, well, I looked at it, cursorily. He said, look, that was written by one of the opposing pressure groups that's trying to really do us in, and there's language in there that would enthrone this pressure group as a part of the United States government. I said, look, you're crazy. I said, this has nothing to do with the world. He said, you check and find out who wrote that. So I called up a citizens committee on the Hoover Report that had tried to prepare some legislation and asked the leader of the group over there who had drafted that section of the reorganization bill. And he said, well, he said, it was the last thing we did, and we had a problem of getting somebody with talent to write it because I don't know anything about agriculture, he said. But he said, I had a friend over in this agricultural association over in the next block, you see. The other pressure group.
Sure.
There it was. And this made it possible for the senator to realize that there was some hanky-panky going on here.
Well, what are the other functions, Steve? Our time is going short.
Well, let me just toss off two others. The brokerage function, the capacity of a congressman to relate the government bureaucracy to the public and the public to the government bureaucracy. Down there, you know, you're in the receiving end of mail of all kinds, people wanting to know things that they can't understand or get out of the bureaucracy. Congressman can call up somebody in an agency and say, could you send me this information and my constituent needs it. This can be abused, and it often is abused.
Well, the average guy has no representative in Washington like the powerful lobbies do, and the congressman is his representative.
Precisely, precisely. Well, the final, if we're talking about categories here, the final thing I would say, and it goes back to a matter we talked about earlier, the brokerage function between the expert and the layman. You know, in a world of science and technology, and I agree with much of what you say, that we have a lot of people in Congress who are knowledgeable. But in the hearing process, you know, when a bill comes in and some technical problems are coming up, there are a lot of experts, economists, scientists, so on, who have a language all of their own. And I remember once old Senator Abe Murdoch of Utah, when an economist came in and was talking about functional unemployment. And Abe Murdoch looked at him and he said, young man, would you mind explaining that in words that a senator can understand?
Be a good thing for a lot of sociologists.
Well, the fact is that this is an educational process. The scientist is made to, or economist or whatnot, is made to explain what he's doing in terms that the senator can understand. This means in terms that newspapermen can understand, that radio commentators and television commentators can understand. And this is the filter through which complex matters are brought to the attention of the public.
And now, Steve, I want to ask you a $64 question. It's been 15 or 16 years, as I remember it, since any general study of the role and organization of Congress has been made.
Sure.
Since, which resulted in the Reorganization Act of 1946.
The Follett-Monroney Committee.
Yeah. Suppose now Congress were to undertake a similar comprehensive study of its own role. What do you think are the things that should be on its agenda?
Well, this is a tough one, but I would think that some of the things that were ignored back in 1945 and 46 ought to be brought up for real consideration. This has to do with the role of the leadership committees. I'm talking particularly the Rules Committee.
Yeah.
The function it ought to perform, whether it should be just a traffic cop to keep things orderly, or whether it ought to be able to block recommendations coming up from the other standing committees of the Congress so that the Congress itself cannot vote on them. I mean, with the kinds of problems we face, we ought to examine whether any small group of men ought to have this kind of power.
Whether rules should be a subordinate Congress, really.
Exactly.
Oh.
In the second place, I think we ought to look very carefully into the whole appropriations process. As you well know, Congress can authorize the spending of money in one piece of legislation, but that doesn't mean that anybody can spend the money. It then has to go through the separate filter of an appropriations committee and subcommittees. Oftentimes, these subcommittees are only three men. And effectively, they can, by accident, they can control the determination of legislation on the basis of their own peculiar, oftentimes narrow, view of the world. Whether we should re-examine the whole role of the appropriations committee and subcommittees in this legislative process seems to me very high on the agenda. There are others. The filibuster ought to be looked at very carefully again. But the fundamental question, Peter, is what we've really been talking about all through this session, which is, what is the role of the Congress in relationship to these great issues of public policy? Is it the role of trying to get at the details of expertise, or is it a matter of trying to interpret in a general way what the public interest is and should be?
Thank you, Steve, for coming. Our time is up. But I would suggest that you have suggested in this discussion the major role of Congress, which still is to serve as the eyes and ears, and in a very important way, the voice of the American people in all their manifold diversity and in all of their puzzlement and bewilderment as they too confront these very difficult problems of our civilization. Thank you, Steve, very much for coming.
Thank you for asking me.